You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
In the world of technology, brand and brand management can sometimes be viewed as a dirty word. Today, I'm talking to Tom Buter, who has decades of experience leading brands, leading companies in the tech sector. So it's great to have you on, Tom.
Thank you. Super happy to be here. Looking forward to our chat.
Tom, let's dive straight into it. Give us a little bit of your background, some of the brands and companies you've been at, and then a little bit of a background on Airship, where you are today.
Sure. I'd say the arc of my career from the very early days, I've always been on, I would call it the side of the challenger brand, the challenger concepts, where we were introducing a new way of thinking about something, or in fact, a new way of doing something. And it started way back in the training program when I was at Young & Rubicam. I worked for Dr. Pepper versus Coke, right, as an example. And then through my career, I seem to have always worked for that next level brand. The early days of software, we did work for Lotus versus Microsoft. And that followed really the arc of my career. For the first part of it, I was a consultant strategist helping from the outside, and frankly thought I knew a lot about our clients' business because I was typically playing a senior role as a strategist working with internal teams. But my goodness, once I was plucked out of that consulting role and brought inside, and I accepted the first chief marketing officer role at Red Hat pre its public offering, I was amazed at how much I didn't know from operating from the inside. So for the last 24 years now, I've worked for software companies. And I've helped to introduce new market enterprise software categories and the brands that were leading those. So in the case of Red Hat, it was the whole open source movement, which I think really created ultimately Marc Andreessen's famous saying of software is eating the world. It just enabled us to create more software more quickly through open source techniques. And then I went and worked in a turnaround of a public company that had outlasted its core space of product development, really as a computer-aided design or a CAD vendor, that they invented a 3D modeling. You can now model all these different products and software. And we evolved that to become a product lifecycle management enterprise class category. And ultimately, the goal was to get a seat at the big table where the big investments were being made. And we were able to prove that product development and a platform like product lifecycle management was very much a value creation playbook. And that work really led me to do similar work in other categories with this playbook that I had helped to create there. And I helped introduce the category of customer experience management, software monitoring, and observability. And today I'm at Airship, and we're all about helping brands capture value from their mobile app customers, which are proven to be like 3 to 4 times more valuable than all other customers. We're up against Salesforce, right? So again, a challenger brand, all these clouds. I don't think I'll ever not work for that type of a company because I'm so rooted in it.
What is it that you love about working for a challenger brand? And what are the unique skill sets that you need to have when you're constantly working in a challenger brand compared to working to the leader? Are there any different?
I don't think you can afford to play it safe. First of all, there are a lot of companies that are challenging some form of conventional wisdom or conventional ways. I was fortunate to be able to be a lot more selective in choosing the companies that actually have it backed up with great technology. And so that the idea that Red Hat was a company with under $10 million of revenue and was being looked at as the next public company was pretty amazing. And so we just had to figure out a way to capture attention and get inside of how the minds of people and how they thought about things. And so you have to operate very differently. You have to have a provocative point of view. You have to have people who can advocate on your behalf. There needs to be a level of proof Sometimes that's really hard to get, particularly early, but it's ultimately not what you say. It's what others say about you. And then you have to find ways to be super creative. How do you get one of the most successful companies of all time who's a customer? How do you actually get them to talk about the kind of work that you're doing together when they have rules about, we don't ever endorse any of our quote vendors, and finding ways to get them on stage and have them tell a story and then use that as tie that story to a public earnings call, to some data that the engineering team might have put forth in a Medium channel. So you just have to think differently.
So go back to this. You talked about value creation, and in tech, product engineering, sales typically view themselves as driving the organization forward, and marketing is viewed very much as a lead gen engine. In your experience, how have you been able to have brand play an influence? And whether that, how do you have those discussions and conversations internally with your other stakeholders? Because it's always been a dirty word. It's very rare that even in larger software companies, tech companies, you even see brand management as a dedicated function compared to other aspects of a lot of other sectors, not even talking about consumer in a lot of other B2B or corporate brand structures.
Yeah. The way I think about brand is that brand is simply a reflection of the company strategy, what a brand stands for. And a lot of people don't really actually understand what makes up a brand. And I think about a brand as having a series of elements that taken together make up the brand essence. And frankly, if you can identify the elements and also understand how they link to each other, then you literally have defined the point of the spear. And frankly, you've informed everything that should follow behind it. So the meaning like the wood behind the arrow. So I can give you some examples. The elements of a brand that I have included in it are things like, so what's our vision? A lot of people do pretty well with talking about what we've got today, but they don't necessarily have a vision about where they see things going. And this is like some big sort of BHAG, some big, hairy, audacious kind of a goal. Microsoft at one point said, we envision a day where there's a computer on every desk. Like in those early days when that was so far from being real, that was pretty audacious.
But you know, it's tangible. I think that's a key thing about vision. But the one that really sticks with me these days is GM's, because they said that by, don't quote me on the year, they're going to have zero, basically every single car was going to be electrified. I think it's about 300 emissions. I'm butchering it right now. But the idea of it.
But
very tangible.
Yeah. Right. And a pretty big, audacious goal, right? And so it's like we're going to put a man on the moon. Okay, how do we go about figuring that out? Okay, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. It can't be something that's so far afield as, hang on, that has nothing to do with what we do. But there has to be some connection, clearly. But it's an audacious goal. So that's one. Vision is one. The second is being able to articulate what business you're in. It's like, when you think of this thing, you want to think of this company. I don't know. When you think of open source, you want to think of Red Hat as an example, right? Or if you want to think about electric vehicles, you'll think of Tesla, like that kind of idea. And then it's what position do we have in the world? And that is really the simplest way to describe what you do and what's unique about that. And I'm not talking about four sentences. I'm literally talking about a slide that has each of these seven elements with anywhere from 2 to 6 words for each. What are the beliefs that you have caused you to basically be in the business that you're in and have the vision that you have? And that becomes really interesting. It's what led you to that. Like, people want to understand that because it gives you actually credibility. Then
how important, just on that, Tom, how important is origin story as part of telling that?
So I think your origin story it links back to why it was you started, right? And you had some belief. Mark Andreessen's belief was software is eating the world. And so they built a venture fund out of nowhere. Talk about a challenger brand. They created a venture fund that invested 100% in software. And then they looked at what is software actually starting to change. And then they looked at the different categories and they made these investments across it. But it was the fundamental thesis was it's all about software. So I think that your founding belief system very much informs who you are and what kind of business you're building.
What's an example of a belief system? Whether you want to talk about it at Airship or any of the previous companies that you've been at?
So I did some work for Citrix back in 2012, I think it was. And they were very evolved in terms of trying to understand who they were and where they were going. And I got involved with the company when it had surpassed $1 billion in revenue, and they were wanting to set the course for how do they get to $5 billion. But their core belief was that they believed that you should be able, now this is 2012, you should be able to work from anywhere at any time on any device. In other words, work is not a place. And at the time, like, people had desktop computers, right? Yes, there were laptops, and yes, there were mobile phones, but they didn't talk to each other. You couldn't work remotely because of how things were connected through network systems, et cetera. So that was a belief that really caused their acquisitions. It caused where they were taking the company.
Just so to push on you, what's the difference between that and a vision? So why wouldn't that be their vision? Or what? How different would their vision be to that?
Yeah, clearly should relate, like, tightly. Their vision was, if they were setting out a course that enabled people to work from anywhere, at any time, any place, on any device, what their vision was to envision a world where kind of work and life were harmonious.
Got it. So the vision sort of encapsulates it.
Exactly. So you get it, right? But the point was, like, everybody talks about, oh, you need work-life balance. Their point was work-life balance. Nothing's ever in balance because life happens. And we know this is, again, 2012, like pre-pandemic, when we all discovered, life interrupts us, right? We're all working remotely and stuff happens. And that was their point. It's like, how do you enable that, the ideal of a harmonious relationship? I'm not sure you can ever quite, but they're certainly going to help work towards it.
So we've probably both seen across countless of companies, great examples of vision statements and these elements written, and not so great ones. And it's not as if in each of these scenarios, you get to write it and then everyone says, great, we're done. What gets in the way oftentimes is the internal, is too many cooks and everyone wanting to wordsmith it. And you worked for a lot of CEOs as well. Maybe talk about a couple of the stories or things that you had to do to manage that process internally so you get to a good outcome and not one of those convoluted examples.
At some point, you need to have enough confidence, and I guess the word is juice, to actually stop the consensus building and be willing to take a bold path and pursue it. But you need to enroll people who have influence in an organization in that vision, right? In that approach, because ultimately they're going to help persuade others like them more so than me, right? Because my role has expanded over time as the marketing person. There's what you do is either just marketing or it's actually everything, right? Like, this ultimately is going to be the difference between really success and failure, or success and just marginal path. But finding people who have a lot of credibility in the organization, who've maybe been a part of the contribution of what you've created. Certainly, you've got to talk to all these people and get their views that'll feed where you want to take things. But pulling them in and having be part of the sort of future, like really be part of it, both feet on the ground kind of thing, is really key. And I'll give you an example. So when I talked about this turnaround that I was involved in, this was a company that had gone from zero to $1.2 billion in about a dozen years. It had invented a category of software. It had built a legendary, extraordinary sales force, and had done a lot of this without any marketing. The problem was that others came along, and they had similar software that did 75%, provided 75% of the value at 25% of the price. It was a lot easier to use, and they were a heck of a lot nicer to deal with. But the company was so good at selling, they kept selling and selling to the point where you know, the only way to get rid of those salespeople was actually to buy something. And so when I got there, it was in a post 9/11 environment. The economy was very much uncertain. The world was uncertain. And the company, for the first time in its history, missed two quarters in a row. Given all of the other factors I just mentioned, it was in a world of hurt. It was trading at a little over 1x current revenue, which is like unheard of in software. So the board bought the vision of what needed to happen, which was more of an enterprise approach to software, in this case, to product development. And they turned to the CEO and said, you need to bring somebody in and who can help tell this story. And that was me. So to say that I was dealing with an organization that was extremely proud, extremely tough, and extremely bright, and I was a change agent, was a really difficult role. And it was probably some of the best and most exciting work I'd ever done. So it basically, we helped market category, which was like products matter and they create great value. And then we helped reposition this company as a leader in that new space. And we helped ultimately get a seat at the table. And I created this value playbook. I created a value. I looked around for the, like, how do you win in this space? And it didn't exist. And so we literally created it. And if products were so important, only two of the Fortune 500 had a chief product officer. So we clearly were tapping into something, especially when executives were cutting their way to success and they were desperate to find other ways of creating value. And so here I was with like this brand approach of talking about like what children don't go to bed on the evening before their birthday in the hopes of unwrapping like a CRM system, or people don't get a tattoo from a CRM system. We had all these really interesting ways to talk about the category. And yet we also had this playbook over here that was basically built for companies to use internally. And so when I kept exposing it in draft form at all of our executive briefings, and people started to really lean into it. And then some of the sales team really leaned into it. And some of these people were super, I would say, influential. So when I did our roadshow, our kickoff for the year, I had put together some very compelling work, some really emotional stuff, as well as the kind of what felt like a consulting approach also. And I got a standing ovation in Europe. I literally got applause in Japan. Everyone's like, Tom, you're not only not going to get a standing ovation, people are going to sleep through your entire presentation. That's just how it is there. And I got applause. And then in China, between the Chinese and the Korean, they were just super excited. And then I got to North America and it was like, everybody was like, arms crossed. What the heck is this all about? And I gave the same compassionate presentation, the evidence of it working. And then I said, just in case you don't really understand this is the future, here's somebody to talk to you. And it was like one of those salespeople. And he was like, basically he said, I've taken this now for the last 3 months and I booked all of this business and I've changed the relationships and I've done this and done that. And I'm here to tell you. And he was very, I would just say, extremely aggressive and forceful in what he was saying. He basically said, if you don't adopt this, you're not going to be here next year. And so it really caused, like, it was a moment, right? And then we just worked really hard with the sales team, with the training team, with enablement, with the product team. I just infiltrated all of these places to get other people to advocate. And frankly, it worked.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a real story of ambassadorship that you built and that notion of finding someone who is a real supporter, who believes in the same idea, who can deliver that message and other people listen to them.
The other thing that was made it particularly difficult is that we literally had 5 reductions in force. So we had 5 layoffs in 18 months. While this was happening, I talked to the CEO. I said, listen, just tell me where I need to get to and let's go there right now because this is too important. I don't want to keep having people looking over their shoulder. Let's just cut to where we need to get to and then let's go forward. We were able to do that with 40% of the staff originally when I walked in the door. There is a lesson also in this because I've had a couple of these experiences you learn sometimes the hard way, right? And that is, how do you ultimately get your CEO to advocate for what it is you're doing when that CEO doesn't come from your world? So the initial instinct is to educate them. This is why this matters. This is what others are doing. Here's some data to support that. But it's like you're talking a different language. And what I realized in two experiences that my point of reference had to be his particular, in this case, they're both males, their point of reference. I had to talk about how they can see what we were introducing through their lens. In this case, they happen to both have roots in sales, and they were super competitive in both cases. Very similar personalities, actually, two different companies. And it was amazing to me because we were absolutely crushing it, I thought, from all intents and purposes. But there was just something that was missing until somebody once said, you realize you're trying to educate this person who believes that their view of the world is right. So you need to reorient what you're trying to do through their lens. And my guess is you'll probably get way more acceptance in that. And this was despite the fact that everybody else in the company was like on board.
So double click into that a second then, Tom, because I think it's a very common challenge, right? Which is, how do you start to bring in marketing or brand story through that sales lens? How do you do that?
I think it's one of the elements that I always include in this sort of brand pyramid is emotion. And I think you have to understand what the emotional response is that you're trying to trigger, because that will help you shape what that brand is all about. And frankly, that's maybe even more important internally than it is externally, but it's equally true. And one of those, so what's an emotional trigger? It could be confidence, could be excitement. It could be inspirational. It could simply be belief. And so in this case, you ultimately had to tap into somebody's belief that there was a better way and this was the right way. And then you had to back it up. But ultimately, I knew that I had to get them to believe.
So when we were talking earlier, you talked a lot about the importance of language, which is an area that it's a real passion point of yours. And I think we're relating it to even actually what we call things internally. Every company has their own language. But to talk a bit about the importance of language to you, how you use it and where you use it.
Yeah, I think words matter a lot. And I may be a little bit too obsessed about that, but I've seen there's a big difference in phrases that look similar, but at the end, they really actually mean different things. And the reason why words matter is because you ultimately want people to be saying the same thing. It's okay for them to ad lib around it, right? To have their own sort of spin on it, but you want them to use a phrase or two and have everybody lean into that and use that. That's how you create momentum. Because if literally even our executive team, there are people that are rooted a little bit in, they firmly believe in our strategy and they firmly believe in what it is we're doing. But sometimes I notice that their language is slightly different. So we literally created a handbook of words to use and not words to use and how to use them. I always try to correct it, because some of these people are particularly influential in terms of like their size of their teams. And it becomes a little bit of their point of view versus the company's point of view. And I'm trying to institutionalize that. Again, I'm not saying that we're trying to have people literally repeat the exact same words in all circumstances. I'm not saying that. What I am saying, though, is there's a few of those things that just matter a lot, and you want their perspective and then their context to support those words, and they can come at it however they want to come at it. But at the end of the day, you just stand for something.
Any good examples from any of your current or past?
Well, I think when I went to work at Sprinklr, Raji Thomas had you talk about a bold vision. His vision was that there needs to be a front office operating system, which was effectively an operating system that was built around the customer, and that the world was completely different of social media, which is where he started his business. And it wasn't what you said anymore, it was what everybody else is saying about you. And you're now out of control, and you have to either choose to participate in that or not. Because if you don't, you're dead. His vision was so far out there that it literally was hard for people to translate where they were with where he saw the company going. And so an operating system for the front office versus their current position as a social media management platform, there's a big leap. And so I basically helped create the bridge, and we created this digital customer first transformation system of models that help companies organize their internal teams and their strategies and their ultimately with the things that they measured around their customer. And we invested a lot of money and then did all these workshops inside of organizations. And it was only through that work that we were able to show that, yes, the customer matters and this is how to go about it. And ultimately, it's an investment that is going to make a difference in the future, which then could be seen as maybe it is an operating system for the front office. You know what I mean? So the company didn't gain the level of momentum, become an enterprise class of software with just his vision and where they were. They needed that bridge. And we went from doing 3 deals over $1 million to 34 deals over $1 million in 2 years. It just changed the dynamic. It changed who we actually needed to hire. Right? We needed a very different type of a selling organization. But that bridge, it took a few years, but that's the bridge that took them to where they are today as the only unified customer experience management platform.
A lot of great lessons from the trenches there. So just to go into some of your personal experience, clearly hired a lot of people and you've been part of a lot of different teams. What's your best interview question that you use with everyone?
Yeah, my best interview question.
Your favorite or your interview question that you like to use?
I like to ask people what they believe in that they don't think other people believe in. What do you believe to be true that you don't think other people believe to be true, and why? So what I'm looking for is original thinking.
Yeah. If you don't mind me putting you on the spot, how would you answer that question?
I believe in magic.
Yeah. What kind of magic?
Yeah. No, I believe in the power of belief, just like fundamentally. And if you ask me, like, what gets me excited, why do I keep signing up for another effort? It's because there's something really powerful when you see belief take hold and you feel momentum. Like, momentum is super powerful, right? And the thing that you're operating against makes me want to continue to push for that. The thing you're operating against is the most powerful, I think, barrier that every company has to deal with, and it's called inertia.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, it's just...
Mine is that I don't believe that you can convince anyone of anything.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Because people have their beliefs. I think all we can do is present people with information.
Yeah.
And they'll decide whether they want to change their mind.
And that's what's been interesting about this kind of work, this kind of playbook that I've somehow developed, is there's this literally two very different pieces of the playbook. And the first is, like, how do you present something in a way that really taps people emotionally, that gets them to look maybe differently at something and feel something? Could be agreement, could be surprise, all that, right? But then how do you create the tangible approach that actually can prove to create and capture value? They're very different things, but when they work together, that's when you can create momentum and you can move. You can really move things in ways that you couldn't otherwise, in my view. Otherwise, it's just marketing, or it's a consulting firm coming in and giving you lots of stuff to work with. And that's just part of a way you do stuff, as opposed to it's actually connected to the big things.
With all of your experience, how do you stay fresh and current?
I try to pay attention. I was in a conversation last night that was talking about, I was in New York, and I met some people that happened to be friends of an architect friend of mine who used to inspire me a lot. And we just started going and started talking about, like, the beginning of the meatpacking district and how that happened. And we were at the Chelsea Hotel, and which has just been completely renovated, and the history that took place there and some of the people that were part of that and the influence that they had. That was a spontaneous conversation, and I was quite fascinated by it. So I picked up a lot of stuff. I bought a book based on what they suggested today, and I just try to stay attuned. And you find it when you're not looking for it. Museums, I watch shows. I find some shows to be interesting just because they're entertaining. But in other cases, they've told a story. Like, I watch a lot of documentaries and I really love that medium. And when a story is told, man, I think it's because it's about real people, right? And real life, and it's not fabricated. And I think that's really compelling. And ultimately, what I'm trying to do is change people's approach to things. So it is real, very real. So
any recent examples of a brand that you love or admire that is doing what you just talked about, telling those real stories in a way that you admire?
I think Stanley Tucci had basically...
Interesting example. Talk more about that.
He created a brand for himself, Come With Me, and discover parts of Italy you didn't know existed. And he did it as one of them, but also as the custodian of the journey. David Gelb, who created Chef's Table, this series, created the first version of that was an actual movie called Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And when I watched Chef's Table, I thought, this feels really familiar. And then I saw the credit and I realized, he was the guy who, and I love Jiro Dreams of Sushi because you talk about a story like, oh my God. And I think Netflix is doing a great job of bringing those kinds of things, whether it's Formula One racing or whether it's the ATP tennis tour or the golf tour, or just bringing the real life story. We hero worship a lot of these athletes and such, chefs, and every one of them has gone through the paper that I wrote in my senior year in college, which was called The Quest Theme. It was the quest theme in American literature, but it's this idea of a quest is you have an ambition to do something in most cases, but there's always something that happens that's causes you to have to suffer or rethink, challenge yourself. You're usually pretty significant. You just when you least expect it, whether in sports, it's injuries or there's other things out of your control. But figuring out how to, like in the case of that one company, the fact that they were trading at one times revenue, Wall Street is basically saying, you guys are done. And here we are.
Find your quest. So the quest can really be that unifier.
Exactly. Exactly.
Tom, we could feel like we could go on for hours. Thank you so much for being on and sharing learnings and wisdoms with us today.
I'm not sure about wisdom, but accumulated a lot of experience. And I remember when I was the youngest guy in the room for many years, and now I have a lot of stories to tell. And I love to be able to share and hopefully have some influence. Gabriel, thank you for your time. And I do look forward. Let's just chat another time, whether it's being recorded or not.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face, and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.